If you've not yet turned to Daniel, let me encourage you to do so, and let me tell you how much I've enjoyed being with you this week, and getting together as we have, and to be with the Allens, who are more family than friend, and other friends that I've met and have gotten to know, and folks who know some of my family. It's just been a tremendous blessing for me. Let me tell you three reasons why the book of Daniel was written. It was written, number one, to make sure the Jews understood that when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, Judea, it was not because the Babylonian gods were strong and Jehovah was weak. Verse 2 makes it clear that it was Jehovah, the Lord God, who gave Judah, Jehoiakim, into the hand of the king of Babylon. And Daniel was written to make sure that the Jews understood that the Messianic kingdom would not be set up at the fall of Babylon. There would be four kingdoms, and it would be in the days of the fourth kingdom that the God of Israel would set up a kingdom that would never be destroyed. And thirdly, the book of Daniel was written to make sure that the Jews understood God had not violated the Davidic covenant. Back in Psalm 89, God made a covenant with David in which he gave to David and his sons the right to rule Israel forever. And the question comes up, well, what if the sons of David don't have the faith of David? God says, if that happens, I'll beat the fire out of them. But I'll never remove from the house of David the right to rule Israel. And when the sons of David got so wicked that God couldn't tolerate them on the throne anymore, he took them off the throne, and for 600 years he ruled Israel through Gentiles. But in the days of that fourth kingdom, a son of David was raised up who was put back on the throne. I want to speak from the book of Daniel this morning. You know, for sheer interest, there are few books that are better than a study of Daniel. And Daniel is often studied with an emphasis on the message, because it's in Daniel that we read about the 70 weeks, the abomination of desolation. It's in Daniel that we read about the statue and the four kingdoms. But I want to study the book this morning from the perspective of some men who are in Daniel, some men who achieved a very high degree of notoriety because of the stand they took. And let's begin by going to Daniel chapter 1. Mark introduced us in his reading of the study. And notice in verse 4, the selection of certain men to work in the Babylonian bureaucracy. Nebuchadnezzar gives the order that there's to be a screening process. And the Babylonians weren't looking for just anybody. They were looking for individuals who qualified in three areas. Now they end up getting four individuals who qualified in a fourth area. And because of their qualifications in the fourth area, that set them head and shoulders above everybody else who was qualified in the first three areas. But if you will, look at verse 4 of Daniel chapter 1. Here are the qualifications. Children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored, skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge, understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar was wanting men in his government who were healthy, who were smart, and who were poised. He wanted men in whom there was no blemish, who qualified physically. And the language that's used here speaks of physical health. And sometimes it's even used of moral health. And there's a connection often between one's moral health and one's physical health. You let your morals go, and chances are you're endangering yourself physically. And we don't talk a lot, do we, in our studies about the importance of taking care of ourselves physically. Maybe we should emphasize that a little bit more. About the only thing I ever hear said about our physical health is that bodily exercise profits little. You know, but godliness is profitable unto all things. And we say that, and we've said about all we've got to say. But can you imagine the benefits that would accrue to the kingdom If we could get people to take a little bit better care of themselves, and instead of dropping dead of a heart attack at 55, we've got them around till they're 70, or 75, or 80. You know how old Churchill was when he became the Prime Minister of England? 65 years old. At the time, most of us are looking to head to St. Petersburg and spend our retirement down there or some warm place like that. Churchill is saving the free world, and he had the health and the stamina for that to happen. So the Babylonians wanted people who were healthy. They wanted people who were smart, who were skillful in wisdom, who were cunning in knowledge, who understood science. They wanted men who could figure out how to solve problems, who could look at a situation and rather than being stumped by it, could see a way through it. Men who were capable of abstract thinking. And they were looking for men who had the ability to stand in the king's palace, in the king's presence, without causing embarrassment. You know, anytime you're involved in government, there's all kinds of protocol and there's all kinds of traditions that have to be observed. And if you overlook one of them, someone might be insulted. So they had to have men who could come off looking good when they were representing the king. I mean, just about every government's got problems with underlings who do something or say something that casts reflection upon the king. Nebuchadnezzar didn't want anyone like that. And so they went out looking for men who fit these qualifications, and they found four Jews by the name of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We know the latter three better by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these four qualified in those three areas, but they qualified in a fourth area as well, and that was the spiritual area. And we know about Daniel's qualifications in that area. He's called a man of God, and in Scripture, that expression, man of God, usually refers to public teachers of the Word. Elijah and Elisha were men of God. In fact, when the Shunammite woman makes reference to Elisha, she never calls him Elisha. She calls him the man of God. I mean, if people don't know our name, let's hope they know us as a child of God, if not as a man of God. Timothy is told to study to show himself approved, but as a man of God, he might be recognized by the life he lives and the word he preaches. And so Daniel was one of those great individuals in Scripture. And in verse 8, after Daniel's been selected, it says he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And I find that remarkable, that Daniel drew the line regarding his diet. You know, they sent him to school, and he didn't say, I don't want this Babylonian education. It's just going to fill me with a bunch of humanism. He didn't say that. And they gave him a job, and he didn't say, I don't want a job in this government, because this government isn't going to be around very long. In fact, Daniel lived to see the end of that government. And they gave him a new name, and he didn't say, the old name's good enough for me. But he said, I'm not going to eat what you're putting on the table in front of me. And I'm not sure I understand why he said that. I'm not sure if that was because he thought the food was unhealthy or he thought the diet was ungodly in some way. Babylonian meals often involved at the start, instead of them saying prayer to Jehovah, they would make some kind of commitment of the meal to their gods. So I'm just not sure exactly why Daniel said no to the diet, but he did. And the Babylonians went along with it, and so they sent him to their MBA school there in Babylon. And if you look at the end of chapter 1, when they're brought in to meet the king, verse 20, In all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. He says, man, we've never turned out 4 guys like this. But his schools had very little to do with it. It was because of their spiritual commitment that these 4 became known as we know them today. Now, what I would like to do this morning is to take you to chapter 3 and talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These 3 people, these 3 boys, made an impact on Babylon that was out of all proportion to their place in Babylon. And it was because of their commitment to God. If you're wanting to make a difference at work, if you're wanting to make a difference in your family, in your congregation, it's only going to happen if you've got a solid commitment to God. And in chapter 3 of Daniel, we read about their commitment. And I want to tell you the story of chapter 3. Now, I know you know the story, but I want you to know that I know it. So I'll tell you the story in Daniel chapter 3. At the start of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar has made a statue 90 feet tall of gold. It seems he was enamored with this dream and the interpretation of the dream in chapter 2. He has a dream. He doesn't know what it means. He calls in his magicians, his astrologers and seers. He says, tell me what I dreamed and tell me what it means. They said, no, you tell us what you dreamed, we'll tell you what it means. I could have done that. And Nebuchadnezzar was smart enough. I mean, I could have told him anything. How would he have known the difference? And that's what they were going to do, but he wasn't that foolish. He said, no, you tell me the dream and tell me what it means. And they couldn't. But there was one who could, and that was Daniel. And Daniel says, here's what you dreamed. You saw this statue, and the head and shoulders were of gold, and that's you, Nebuchadnezzar. And apparently enamored with that idea, in chapter 3, he's putting up this 90-foot-tall golden colossus, this statue. The Colossus of Rhodes was 105-foot-tall, they say. And so he's got this remarkable statue put up, and he gives the command that whenever you hear the orchestra play, the royal orchestra, everybody stops what they're doing. They turn toward the statue and they bow down and worship it. And so the orchestra plays and everybody bows down except 3 who stood up. And there were some Chaldeans, while they were bowing down, apparently were peeking around because they see these 3 standing up. And the green-eyed monster rears its head here in this chapter. And these Chaldeans, starting with verse 8, they come near to accuse the Jews. And the word translated accuse there means to bite, to eat. Paul warns about biting and devouring one another. And that's what these Chaldeans, who resent the intrusion of these Jews into their bureaucracy, this is the establishment going after the outsiders. And so they're going to cut the outsiders down a notch or two. And they say, verse 10, King, you have made a decree. I mean, they distance themselves from what's going on here. This is your doing, King. You made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whosoever doesn't fall down and worship the golden image shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. A threefold accusation. They disrespect you. They disrespect the gods. They disrespect this image. 3 strikes, they ought to be out. But to Nebuchadnezzar's credit, he doesn't act hastily. He calls for him to be brought in. And He's never had any trouble with these boys before. I think he has a hard time believing what he heard. And so he asks him in verse 14, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true? And I find it interesting when he asks him about what he heard, he doesn't talk about the disrespect to himself. Is it true that you don't worship my gods and you've not paid honor to the image? And he doesn't wait for an answer. He says, well, listen, whether it's true or not, I'm willing to forget all of that if the next time you hear the music, you'll bow down. If you'll do that, everything's forgotten. We'll pretend this never happened. But I'm warning you, there's a limit to my patience. And if the next time you hear it, you don't bow down, you're going to be thrown into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God that shall deliver you out of my hand? Moses goes down to Egypt and says, God says, let my people go. Pharaoh says, who is this God that I should listen to him and let your people go? Moses said, oh, you don't know who the God is I'm talking about? And he signed him up in a correspondence course, 10 lessons. And after the end, Pharaoh knew the God that Moses was talking about. Nebuchadnezzar says the same thing. Who's the God that can deliver you out of my hand? He is about to find out. And so he makes that generous gesture to these three. And start reading with me, if you will, in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Three of the greatest words in the book of Daniel. But if not. King, we don't have to talk among ourselves about how we're going to answer. We don't have to go into a huddle. We know what the answer is. The God we believe in certainly has the power to deliver us out of your hands. You want to know the God who can do that? Well, our God can do that. We don't know if he will. And even if he doesn't, that doesn't change our answer. Because we know his will concerning us. We don't know what he'll do about this, but we know what he wants us to do. And that's to not bow down, and we're not bowing down. And when Nebuchadnezzar heard that, he blew up. The text says his commandment was urgent. He's screaming, he's yelling. And he gets guards in and they grab him. And he commands that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than normal. Now, skeptics used to jump on that little bit of information in chapter 3 here about how it was that these three were thrown into a furnace, because Babylonian furnaces there in Iraq, in that part of the world, were often very small things, small ovens that when you were making bricks, you could walk right up to, set the bricks in, fire it up, harden the bricks, take them out. And they didn't have furnaces, the skeptics used to say, into which men could be thrown. But they don't say that anymore, because what they have found that the Babylonians did have furnaces into which somebody could be thrown. At the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, they've got two of the lions from the Ishtar Gate. I mean, that's my favorite display, I think, in that museum. The actual lions that Daniel probably saw every day on the way into work. And those lions are multicolored. And the Babylonians, in order to make the porcelain bricks with the colors, had special furnaces, special ovens, about 8-10 feet high or so, divided into two sections, a top section, a bottom section. The bottom section was the larger section. That's where they would pile the fuel. the wood, whatever they were burning. They had to get the temperature hot enough for the chemical reaction to occur to make the porcelain that was up there in the top section. And so those furnaces were certainly big enough for someone to be thrown into, and that's probably what Nebuchadnezzar's talking about. And so they put the fuel into the furnace there, and then they grab Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they throw them into the fire, and that fire's been stoked up so high that when those three hit the fire, the flames jump out. I used to have a wood-burning stove, and back home in Illinois, the hardest wood to burn, the hardest wood that's native to America is what we call hedgewood. I think it's called Osage Orange. It's harder than hickory, harder than oak, harder than anything else. And that's what I would burn. I'd cut up old hedge posts. I had to use a big saw on the end of a tractor to cut them. And there'd reach a point where in the burning of that hedgewood, if the log shifted, it was like the 4th of July. There'd be an explosion of sparks and fire everywhere. You had to be very careful burning it. Make sure you had the doors to the wood stove closed. And they throw these three into the furnace. And the flames come out and incinerate the guards who had taken them to the furnace. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in the furnace. Now you think about the temptation that was confronting them, of just bowing down to an altar that meant nothing to you, and you knew it meant nothing, and you could have used some mental reservation. I'm sure I could have come up with a dozen reasons to justify me bowing down to that thing and salved my conscience, especially when the heat's being turned up on that furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't do that. Remember when Naaman was converted after his leprosy was cured, and he's going back and he sends word, now part of my official duties are to go into the temple of the God with the king and to go through the process of bowing down, but Elisha, I want you to know I don't mean any of that. That's just my job. That's just what I got to do. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego surely could have reasoned that way, but they didn't. And so they've got the furnace there, but let me mention three other things that were going on that you can pile on top of the threat of cremation. The first of which is that they were young. Has anybody ever tried to justify sin on the basis that the one doing the sinning is young and just getting it out of his system, sowing his wild oats? I mean, we justify all kinds of things on the basis of the age of people. And youth comes with its own special set of temptations. And young folks can make mistakes. It doesn't take very long to ruin your life. You know what? 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it is all it takes to ruin your life. But a lot of young people take the risk because when you're young, you feel immortal. You feel like you're never going to die, going to live forever. And that sort of dulls them to the danger of whatever they might be contemplating. So these three boys, I don't know how young they were, but they were young. And secondly, they were away from home. I mean, to the thought of immortality, add the thought of anonymity. Now, I got to know Jim because he was in the Air Force, and I grew up where there was an Air Force base, Chanute Air Force Base, and it was a technical training base. Fellas would go through Lackland basic training, and then depending on the job they were given in the Air Force, they would come up to Chanute. And I can't tell you how many occasions we would get a phone call from some family member wanting to know how their boy was doing, because they assumed that he had been assembling with the saints and worshiping with us, and everything was going fine. And on many occasions we'd have to say, we don't know who you're talking about. We've never seen this person. He's never been to church. And some folks when they get away from home and nobody knows them. I mean, that's prodigal son kind of stuff, isn't it? When you get out to the far country where nobody knows you, nobody cares about you, and you can indulge yourself, if you have the wherewithal, in whatever your heart is set on. These three had the immortality of youth. They had the anonymity of being away from home. And thirdly, everybody was doing it. Young, away from home, everybody was doing it. And the pressure of peer pressure. Immortality, anonymity, uniformity. Not sticking out. Not being the oddball. Being accepted is such an important part of our psyche. To be taken in, to be thought as one of the group, to not be laughed at, to not be rejected. And everybody was doing what they were asked to do. And so you pile those three temptations on top of the fiery furnace temptation, and what a temptation they were facing. And in light of all of that, what they said is all the more remarkable. Because what they said is this. They simply said, no, we're not bowing down. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he has this practice of wanting to get at the meaning of his dreams and wanting to get at the deeper interpretation of something. He had called in the wise men. He didn't call in any wise men when they said no. I mean, they said it in such a way that he perfectly understood what they were saying. Let me tell you what I found out in my life. I found out when the devil comes with some temptation and I'm mealy-mouthed about it. Yeah, I kind of half mumbled, no, I don't think I want to do that. That doesn't make him go away. Have you found that to be the case in your situation when you are kind of wishy-washy about whether you want to go along with this or not, that, well, if you're not wholehearted, the devil says, I'm just not going to mess with you, he leaves. Is that what you found to be the case? That's not what I found. What I found is, if I try to be ambiguous, if I try to equivocate in saying no, why, the devil just pours the heat on. Hey, he just turns the heat up. He renews his efforts. The only time I get any peace from him is when I finally make him understand I'm not bowing down. And it's hard to get to that point sometimes, isn't it? Because for so many reasons, you might want to bow down. But when you can finally make him understand, I'm not bowing down. Turn to Titus chapter 2. Paul says something here in Titus chapter 2 that can be brought into the discussion at this point. Verse 11. For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. The New International Version in verse 12 says that the first thing the grace of God does is to teach us to say no. To say no to ungodliness. And that's what these three did, and they did it by faith. They knew there was a God in heaven, and the God that was in heaven was the God they worshipped. And nothing that Nebuchadnezzar said or did, or they said or did, changed that. But their commitment was to the true God. And they were determined to stand up and not bow down to that world's idols. And Nebuchadnezzar goes and looks in the furnace. I don't know if he opened the door where they loaded the fuel in. I don't know how he looked in the furnace, but he looks in the furnace. Probably out of a morbid curiosity, maybe out of some regret. I'm not sure. And not only does he see the figures of three individuals in the fire, he sees a fourth that he says was likened to the Son of God. And I'm not sure exactly who it was that Nebuchadnezzar saw. Was it an angel? Was it Christ? I'm not sure. But these three decided it was better to be in the fire with God than in favor with man. And that's why we read about them. Because of that choice, because of that decision that they made. Before the Caesars came to power in Rome, when Rome was still a republic, there were some kings. And the last of the kings was a man by the name of Tarquinius Superbus. Now that was the name he gave himself. He gave himself the name Superbus because he thought he was somebody. But he wasn't. He was a jerk. And the Romans finally got tired of him and threw him out. And so to retaliate, three times he tried to bring Rome to ruin, once by the Volscians, twice by the Etruscans. And the third time he convinced Porsanna, king of the Etruscans, to march against Rome. And the Etruscan army came up, surrounded the city. A guy by the name of Horatio was holding the bridge. And he held them off till they dismantled the bridge behind him. And then he jumped into the Tiber and swam across to Rome. And the Etruscans set up a blockade. They were going to starve Rome into submission. And the situation in Rome got desperate. Got so bad that finally there were 300 young men who got together and swore to one another by an oath that they would not eat until they had killed Porsanna. That night, one of them, by the name of Mucius, swam across the Tiber and under the cover of darkness slipped into the Etruscan camp. And he got in there, pulled his knife and killed the most important man that he saw, hoping it was Porsanna, but it wasn't. It was the royal treasurer. They were paying the troops. And Mucius was captured immediately. And then he was hauled before Porsanna. Porsanna says, well, we're wanting to know how bad things are in Rome. We're wanting to know how close the city is to capitulating. And I intend to get that out of you, that information out of you, by torturing you. And there was a censer over to the right of the throne where they had a fire burning. Mucius walked over, put his right hand into the fire, held it there and said, and I'm paraphrasing the Latin. Now, what was that you said about torture? And boy, Porsanna was taken back by that and was so impressed by the gallantry Mucius showed that he says, hey, I'm going to let you go. A man as brave as you shouldn't die. And Porsanna, in gratitude for being given his freedom, said, well, I've got to tell you, Porsanna, there are 299 more just like me who are not going to rest until you're dead. And when Porsanna realized the resolve that he was facing, he lifted the siege and went home. Because one boy stood up. And ever after, said Levy, they called him Mucius Scaevolus, which means lefty. Right hand's burned, he can't use it anymore. But because one boy stood up. I wonder whom we might save if we're willing to stand up at work. If we're willing to stand up in our family, willing to stand up among our friends, willing to stand up in church, willing to stand up for Jesus because of our faith, we can quench the violence of fire. That's what the Hebrews writer in chapter 11. That was his final word about this. By faith, we can quench the violence of fire. We can live a life that the fire will never touch us. Now, temptation might touch us, persecution might get at us, death will come, but we can live the kind of life where the fire will never touch us. And God bless you as you seek to live that kind of life, and as you seek to stand up in whatever situation you find yourself and reflect honorably and nobly the God we serve. God bless you. If you're here this morning and need to be on the side of that God, serving Him, and you need to confess that He's your Lord and repent, make that commitment to say no to sin, to get out of the sinning business, and to be buried in baptism for the remission of sins. We hope you'll take this opportunity to act and to respond and to come while together we stand and while we sing.
Would you live for Jesus and be always pure and good? Would you walk with